Before we start the show, wanted to let you know that as of this taping, there are a few tickets left for our Friday, November 18th live show, which is part of the Chicago Podcast Festival. Adam and I, along with Michael Phillips, will be sharing a bill with Matt and Allison from Film Spotting SVU. That's right, two Film Spotting family shows for the price of one. The show is at 7 p.m. at Shuba's. That's in Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood. We hope to see you there. For ticket and more information, go to filmspotting.net or chicagopodcastfestival.org.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips.
Everything you're doing there, I have to explain to a room full of men whose first and last question is how can this be used against us?
Kangaroo.
What is that?
We try and make it policy to avoid spoilers on the show, but the arrival aliens, yep, they're kangaroos.
Yeah, that was a bold choice, I thought.
No, actually, not kangaroos in Arrival. But the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips is here with me for this week. He's going to help me review a couple of the weekend's new releases, including that alien invasion flick Arrival and Jeff Nichols' new one, Loving. That's about the Virginia couple who brought an end to the ban against interracial marriage. That and more, and this is where Adam would goad me into making a kangaroo noise, but he's off this week. Ahead on Film Spotting. Michael, we're recording this show early on Tuesday, election day here in the States, so by the time listeners actually hear the show, we will have elected a new president. Now, I still need to get to the polls. How about you?
Same. Thwarted this morning.
You tried.
That adorable Lutheran church around the corner was an hour late opening the door.
Ooh.
So, yeah, long,
didn't quite
long
have their
line.
Act together.
Gotta go later. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, then it's even more imperative that we get this show done in a timely manner. We could probably say the future of America depends on it so that you and I can go vote.
Right. I can't. The suspense, seriously. After the Cubs nonsense and, good nonsense, not bad nonsense.
Good nonsense.
But
okay.
That suspense on top of this suspense is, I feel like I'm not ready for any more suspense for a while.
All right. Well, let's get to it then. Later in the show, we'll stage a fight in the war room for Massacre Theater, plus a review of Arrival, a.k.a. Space Kangaroos. And podcast listeners, they're going to hear us opine about Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge. But first, director Jeff Nichols, he knows what we need at the end of this bitter campaign season, a little bit of loving.
I'm going to build you a house. Right here. Our house.
I want to take Mildred up to D.C. to get married.
Are you sure about that?
By the power vested in me by the District of Columbia, I now pronounce you husband and wife.
In here?
Richie!
What you doing in bed with that woman?
I'm his wife.
That's no good here.
Richard Perry Loving, being a white person, and Mildred Jeter, being a colored person, did unlawfully cohabitate as man and wife.
Richard?
One of the great things about Sam Van Halgren, our co-producer here on the show, Michael, is that he always knows how to stir the pot for movie conversation. He was at it again recently when he alerted Adam and I to Richard Brody's review of Loving in The New Yorker. Loving is, of course, Jeff Nichols' dramatization of the 1958 marriage of Richard and Mildred Loving, an interracial couple whose union was declared illegal in Virginia and whose case eventually went to the Supreme Court. In his review, Brody said this: "The definition of slowness in movies isn't absolute. It refers not to the speed of action, but to the ratio of ideas to action." Brody goes on to dismiss Loving, especially in comparison to a 1996 Showtime version of this story that he prefers, mostly because he found its unrushed nature to be unsupported by enough intellectual heft. The movie is certainly slow in terms of action. Nearly every scene is defined by a quiet patience. But I didn't find that to be to the movie's detriment, and even beyond that, I'm not sure I buy Brody's ratio suggestion overall. I think it's an interesting construct, though, so I wanted to get your thoughts on it, Michael, as we get into our review. What's your preferred ideas-to-action ratio at the movies, and how might that apply to Nichols' Loving?
None. I'm threatened by ideas, so no ideas to...
You prefer zero.
Yes, right. That's right. And I'm not even really interested in character development. No, he's getting at something interesting, and I guess, although I like a good deal of this movie, I think there is a limitation or something missing in it. I suspect it's not really about film rhythm, which is what we're really talking about when we say fast and slow. And slow is not really the right word. It's really more measured or methodical. You know, it just slows
for this movie.
Just in general, I think when people say a movie's slow, it just means they're not engaged in some
way. They're describing their own personal reaction.
But objectively speaking, to the degree any of this has anything to do with objectivity, which is none. It's a measured film. As we meet Richard and Mildred Loving, it's, you know, they are people of few words, especially in Nichols' screenplay. And without being patronizing toward them, I would say, you know, they're fairly simple, uncomplicated people who are not civil rights firebrands, who are not if anything, they're the most reluctant of revolutionaries, and they simply want to live the life they want to live together, and the state will not allow it, right? And from those small personal true life stories, you know, great changes can be made in a democracy, which is truly inspiring. I think what's missing in the film and what makes it not one of Nichols' best, I guess, is we only get to – it's an old complaint, but we only get to know these two between the lines. And there's a lot of between the lines time because they're not – nobody's given – this is not a speechy movie. You know, mm-hmm. This is not – and I think Brody's crazy about the Showtime version, at least
based
on the trailer.
Yeah, I haven't seen it myself.
No, thanks. But all the conflict is out and on the surface constantly in that film. But I think what he's getting at is Nichols, I think by temperament as a filmmaker, is so intent on treating every character discreetly, tactfully, with respect, even the truly unsympathetic ones who just want to lock these guys up. It's a certain low simmer can kind of get to be almost the heat goes too low, and we don't really ever hear or see what's going on in their day to day lives, whether they're living it in Virginia, kind of on the down low, or after they're forced out of state and move up to D.C. and live a not particularly happy urban life, and they want to get back to their families and their community back home in Caroline County, Virginia. There's a lack of real life texture in a lot of those family scenes, Josh.
Really?
At least I thought so. In that, you know, you have a lot of, you know, boisterous kids in and out, this and that. There's really kind of no kind of rhythm breaking tumult or sort of everyday. Nobody drops a dish ever. there's not, you know, it's all very kind of neatly and carefully diagrammed as drama. And I was not disinterested in any of it. Mm-hmm. And I think the acting is very good. But I think Nichols has a very fine line. And this is what we're going to watch, I think, as he develops as a writer, director. And look, he's never made a film not worth seeing yet. So that's a damn good
very
sign.
Very true.
But this one, I think, is not quite one of his best because the care he's taking leads to a certain caution in the filmmaking and I think in the character exploration. So that's why I think it's a good film, not a better film. But it sounds like you are more like it's a very good film.
I'm much higher on it. And interestingly, because it hit me in the exact opposite way in terms of those domestic scenes, I felt that was the one idea. I would agree to an extent with Brody that this isn't rife with philosophical exploration.
Right.
But I think it does hit on more than one idea. The one main idea, though, is really how this quiet domesticity evolves into what becomes, despite maybe this couple's personal attempts, revolutionary political action. And so Loving really shows us where that was rooted, and it's in those moments that you're talking about that is all they want to do. They just want to have a home where they can live together and snap the green beans, do the ironing while holding a kid who's crying, fix the car in the shed. That's all they want to do together. Hmm. And I think by cataloging these moments and their little life-building moments, the movie adds up to an actual domestic existence and thereby really emphasizes marriage as this universal right. So the movie itself, becoming speechifying, I think does become something that is very political. Now, you're right that they don't drop a lot of dishes. There's not a lot of drama.
Well, I don't want to obsess over the dishes.
No, but I think what you're getting at, it seems to me, is that even in these domestic scenes, there's nothing – not outlandish, but there's nothing that really grabs you. These are almost snapshots.
And again, this isn't necessarily a criticism, but I think it's a fact that there's no casual offhand moments. There's no details that don't seem exactly purposely put there for a reason. Mm-hmm. So in other words, it doesn't feel like a documentary. Again, a choice and probably a good one. I'm not looking for a documentary. There is a documentary called The Loving Story that this film is actually partly crediting in the credits. And, if you want that, you have that. But I think Nichols' issue as a screen storyteller is he's a quiet, patient, measured filmmaker and storyteller. He's a true humanist. He's got great taste and kind of a sneaky sense of wit, and it's all there in this film again, which I like a good deal in almost every way. But I think there are times when I just simply wanted to see a little more. Dana Stevens at Slate wrote very well on this, much better than I did. But where and she liked it very much too. But there's just a little bit of kind of accidental real life that isn't in this movie. It's all very purposeful, determined, and spare, but varied, very
composed. Maybe so.
And, okay. and this is not like a new style for Nichols. This is why I admire and enjoy so much of movies like Mud and Take Shelter and all the Shotgun Stories, because not every scene is completely on plot and on point. And I think this is a different film for him in that regard, because this is much more like, okay, I have a clear storyline, two protagonists. I'm not dealing with much else in this picture besides these two in this situation. And I think when Nichols' style is put to the right use, as in the first minute or two, where I think there are two words spoken, I'm pregnant, where they're sitting on the porch. We haven't met them
yet. The very beginning
of the film. And they're essentially late teen years, and she simply says, I'm pregnant. And we kind of wait for his response and his sense, a sense of like, okay, how is he receiving this news? What does this mean for their lives? And the beat that is taken, and then an extra beat that is taken. And Joel Edgerton, very crafty actor, very good actor. And Ruth Negga is fantastic. And she's the best thing in it. But that moment in the silence that comes out, okay, now we see what he's thinking. That's a very telling moment, and I like the way he uses silence in that regard. Maybe some of the other silences or between the lines moments in the picture are just a little more studied. I don't know.
I want to put the kitchen back right back here.
Richard, stop this. I don't know what you're saying.
I bought it. This whole acre. I'm gonna build you a house. Right here. Our house.
Speaking of Nichols' other films, and we're a big fan of his here on the show, we positively reviewed Midnight Special earlier this year. I think it's worth pointing out that the cinematography at work here, he's once again working with Adam Stone, who I believe has done all of his pictures. And he really gives these moments of domesticity for me. And maybe this goes back to the composition and the over composition that you saw this. It's sort of like a crumpled glow. So going back to the idea of a family snapshot that's been found, polished up a little bit, right? But it still has those moments where a family is just caught doing what they do, being a family. So I was, to go back to Brody's idea of the ratio of ideas to action, you know, I was content to luxuriate in that one idea of seeing domesticity as a political act and watching how beautifully it was played out in the performances and in the composition and the cinematography. But I think there are a few other things going on here. I want to give Loving a little more credit maybe than that review does. I think there is a lot of interesting stuff going on about community across racial lines. Mm. And it doesn't, again, explore this in a speechifying or preaching way. It more observes what that might look like and the tensions that are even there when you seem to have a harmonious relationship. I think it does get a little bit into the politics behind making a Supreme Court case. I was glad it didn't give itself over to that, but we do see those efforts, and I found that to be interesting. And you mentioned this idea of rural versus urban identity.
Yeah.
Once they are forced to move out of Virginia and they go into a more crowded DC neighborhood, I think that's one of the things the film captures most acutely, especially through the eyes of Mildred. I was really happy to see this not just be the Richard Loving story, you know, it was his and hers.
And she's an actress who'll be new to many people.
And by capturing her just kind of wilting when she moves from the country into the city and how that just kind of crushes her spirit. But Nega, it's not, as you hinted at, she's just wonderful.
Yeah, she's wonderful. And my favorite thing in the movie, and this doesn't give away any plot stuff, but there's another kind of between the silences moments where she's getting very good news on the phone, sort of in the middle of an ordinary day where she's dealing with her kids and laundry and the usual housemaking duties, a lot of it. And she just – I've rarely believed a one-sided fake movie phone call, you know, in terms of like changing somebody's life kind of just almost accidentally. She is just fantastic in it. And actors, if they're good, I think, really love to play a character like that who don't really – you know, who sort of require the audience to lean in and wait for the next thing they're going to say because they're not really talkers or showboaters by nature. And that's these two, right, all the way.
Yes.
And these are wonderful actors. That's – look, reason enough to go for Egerton, especially for Ruth Negga. Really, really good.
That phone conversation, and it's bookended. She gets another phone call, even a bigger earthquake phone call, you could say, towards the end of the film. And the way she registers both of them is – beautiful. I mean, she has to be – depends on what sort of actor you are, but I have to think you're working against almost every actorly urge that you have when you're playing a scene like that.
Right.
And
to kill
just,
it, to sell it.
Yes. Yeah. And she, and to take the burden of communicating the significance of the moment just on your own, right? And instead, she pulls everything back and gives us just enough on her face so that we imperceptibly recognize that this is a life – transforming call that she's getting.
Right.
So not only do I like how it's played in terms of the acting, but I also like how it is also in service of the way this whole movie is approaching this topic, which is going to be understated and not in your face. I mean, think of what a horrible film in different hands this could have been. This could have been something that the story and the subject is just begging in a lot of ways to be self-impressed and grandstanding.
And melodrama
and,
all the way.
And melodramatic. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that Nichols and his filmmakers and his cast, they'll just have none of that throughout.
Yeah. And the casting of Nick Kroll is very good as the ACLU.
Did you like his performance?
Yeah, I did. He plays the ACLU lawyer who, you know, takes the case. And he's kind of green around the edges. And not a particularly smooth he's not really up on the law he needs to be up on to kind of move this case forward up to the Supreme Court. But yeah, he's very good, I think.
I've seen some people resist not only the lightness that he brings into it, but also saying that the movie bungles the handling of the lawyers and how the case is presented. And I don't know if that's because people wanted more of that. But again, maybe. I liked the focus staying on the couple and not becoming suddenly a courtroom drama.
Yeah. And it may, as I said, I think that may be the difference here for, in if you look at the other Nichols films, because you don't – he really is, okay, this is about them. I'm not going to try to spend too much time. I don't have much screen time to spend with the other characters. We're going to kind of keep the focus on these two. Now, your point about kind of understated, that's another word. Maybe that's a code word for some of these other reactions people are having if they don't love loving. If, you know, Pauline Kael once wrote about Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall mm-hmm. and Glenn Close. They're so understated, it's like a new form of mugging. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
You know,
well, and that can happen. Yes.
It can happen, and it can be – and it can get into a kind of almost – it's a flashy withholding
yes.
of what's going on or what's being said. And that's – again, that's just another way to get away from the truth or from the honest moment. There's a lot of honesty in this film. There's a little bit – you know, there's fabrications right and left in terms of what the docudrama is telling the truth about and what it's not factually correct on. Nobody smokes in this film, for one thing. And every one of those photos that showed up in Life magazine, you know, they're both smoking like chimneys. And
I think doesn't he on the porch? There's
he
that
does
one
once,
moment,
yeah.
which is almost a false moment in that here's this guy, Richard Loving, who barely says anything. Instead, we get a sense of how they love each other and how they regard each other, how
yeah.
they look at each other when they hold hands,
mm-hmm.
and that wonderful moment where he lays his head on her lap while they're watching television on the couch. But there's that porch scene where he is smoking, I think, and the
right.
lawyer comes out and he passes along a message of what the lawyer should tell the Supreme Court.
Right.
I think we get a little close to a Richard Loving speech is, I think, four words. But we still do get something of a speech. And, you know, otherwise I like how Edgerton plays him almost inarticulate,
yeah.
which is something of a brave choice because it could seem as condescending.
I think it gives
us an idea of the character.
What I saw in the documentary and other archival footage of the real Lovings, it's absolutely where Edgerton got the idea about kind of how to deal with a guy who does not like to talk much. And, you know, I mean, that's half my family. So it's not like it's an unrelatable trait, you know.
I've seen that.
I've always talked for them, you know. It's a question, though, if it feels – it doesn't have to feel like a documentary or real life. It just has to feel true and honest on its own. And I'd say the movie does, but again, there's what's keeping it out of the very best of Nichols – the list of Nichols films for me is there is some slight gap between the quality of what you're getting in Ruth Negga's performance particularly and all the rest of the film, which is artful – very, very well made, discreet, maybe to a fault. Is it exciting cinema? No, it's not trying to be. It's trying to be other things.
Well, that's your ranking. You mentioned Take Shelter a few minutes ago. That's my favorite Jeff Nichols film.
There
I'm going to put Loving right behind that.
Right second.
Right now.
Okay.
At this
All
point.
Right.
Yeah,
good.
So
good.
I enjoyed it quite a bit. Loving expands to more theaters this weekend. So if you see it and agree or disagree, where do you fall? Closer to Michael, closer to me? Let us know. feedback@filmspotting.net. We did want to mention quickly here over at Filmspotting SVU what Matt and Allison are up to this week. They have a review of another one of my favorite films of 2016. That is Nicholas Winding Refn's Neon Demon. That's new to Amazon Prime. They're also going to take a look at some notable 2016 releases that are available to stream. So you can find more information about that at filmspottingsvu.com. Filmspotting SVU is presented by Movies On Demand on Cable, the art house in your house. Learn more at rentmoviesondemand.com. All right, time to get presidential, Michael. One of us will need to take the oath of office for Massacre Theater. We've got that when we come back. Plus, for our podcast listeners, some Hacksaw Ridge thoughts. Stay with us.
Hello, this is Charles Bradley. Our brother that came from the hard licks of life that knows that America is my home. America, you've been real, honest, hurt, and sweet to me. But I wouldn't change it for the world. Just know that all the pains that I've been through, it made me strong, to stand strong that know America represents love for all humanity and the world. I say from my heart.
God bless. second that Madison, it was crazy. She was like, and her eyes was like, and then her tongue was like, she dropped to the floor, shaking a lot, shaking. She twisted for a little time. Twist, she got like that, and then zombie. Then she was like, choking and a zombie, so she was like, blah, 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 blah. Choking, and then she was doing it again, spinning around. It was loud. Everyone's getting sick.
Pretty much all the older girls.
Clip there from The Fitz, one of the standout films from 2016, also a Film Spotting Golden Brick candidate. Next week, we're going to be prepping for our live show on Friday, November 18. So next week's episode is going to feature our Golden Brick shortlist, along with a rebroadcast of our Fitz review. We're also going to have Adam's interview with James Solomon. He's the director of The Witness. That's another Brick candidate. Now, that live show on the 18th, that's going to be part of the Chicago Podcast Festival. We've been talking about it the past few weeks on the show. Michael, we're hoping, we're not sure yet, but we're hoping that you're going to be able to join Adam and I for that show on the 18th.
I'm cautiously optimistic.
All right, we'll take that.
I have to, you know, there's some logistical, domestic scheduling, children. If I can get the kids all there singing stuff from Sound of Music, well, I could probably pull it off.
You joke, but I think it's an 18 and over venue at Shuba's, and I actually looked at that as well.
They've been throwing out better venues than that, okay?
For me, it was less that I wanted them to see the show. It was just a childcare thing, you know, if I could bring them along. Well, we do hope that you'll be able to be there, Michael. We're going to mostly make this a show that's a whole top five, and we're thinking about top five films that console and restore hope. Do you see some possibilities in that topic?
You know, there's a film version of The Art of the Deal. Trump related does not fit this description. But
I think we'll probably be going in another direction. Now, a cool thing about this show is that Matt and Allison from Film Spotting SVU, they're going to be the openers. So they'll put in, I think it's about half hour, 45 minutes. Adam and I, maybe you, Michael, will get on stage, do about 45 minutes to an hour or so. So you do get two shows for the price of one in that night. We hope you can join us. Now, the following night, also as part of the Chicago Podcast Festival, this is going to be November 19, you can catch the next picture show crew. So Tasha, Scott, Keith, and Genevieve, they're going to be doing a version of the next picture show on stage live. You can get tickets for that as well right now. There are a few tickets left for both of those shows on the 18th and the 19th. You can buy tickets to one show. You can buy tickets to both shows as part of the festival. For more information, visit filmspotting.net or chicagopodcastfestival.com. Okay, now, we don't want to confuse everybody. That is the live show planned for November, but we have more live podcast news. This is Looking Ahead, and this is going to be part of WBEZ's podcast, Passport. And the topic this year, perfect fit for us as Film Spotting to be a part of, the topic is cinema.
Cinema.
There you go.
There's your topic.
Now, the Passport includes three live podcast tapings, all of which are going to explore the world of film. So the Death, Sex, Money podcast, that's up first. It's next Tuesday the 14th, actually, at the Music Box. Nerdette, show we know very well, former guest host Trisha Bobita is a part of that. They are going to be live on December 21 at Victory Gardens. Then it's our turn, and this is going to be our usual 2016 wrap party. We're going to be doing this on Friday, January 13th. Michael, you've been a part of a couple of those shows, I believe, in the past. This one's going to be at a new venue for us, University of Chicago's Logan Center for the Arts. This is a relatively new venue overall,
oh, yeah,
I understand.
Good, no,
have you been there?
Absolutely. I've seen things there, and it's a nice addition to the U of C campus, and it'll be great to take it down to Hyde Park.
It looks beautiful, and yeah, I do like getting down to that part of the city. How do you think we'll fit there, though? Are we going to, like, class down the place by bringing Film Spotting in?
You'll look like two guys visiting the U of C campus in vain hope of getting accepted there.
So
that's what it's going to look like. But no,
pretty
it's a great
accurate, then.
Yeah, right.
All right, so if you want to be part part of the podcast Passport. That includes admission to all three shows. As I said, it's $50 for WBEZ members. That's $60 for non-members. But WBEZ does encourage you to act fast. Live event series have a history of selling out. There are only a limited number of passports, and those are available through November 14.
And can I just say the live stuff is just great fun. It's great fun to listen to.
It is a lot of fun.
And just be part of it, yeah.
It's hard for me to say that until we're about 10 minutes into the live show because it's a lot of terror for me leading up to that. But once we get rolling, yeah, they've been highlights here in my time at the show. Time now for Masquer Theater. Michael, speaking of something that gives me terror, this is the part of the show where we perform a scene and listeners get a chance at winning a prize. A couple of weeks back, Adam and I maskered this scene.
Does he speak to you, Isaac?
He speaks to me always. But today he is displeased. He is displeased with you, Malachi.
What have I done?
Question him not in vain. Do you not know you did sacrifice Joseph without an offering? And did you not spill the blood of the old man when his oil and gasoline were still useful to us?
We have our own fuel now from the corn.
Show not your pride, Malachi. We have not enough.
Maybe he is displeased that we have not offered him Sarah and Job.
Sarah has the gift of sight. She warned us of the coming of the interlopers. Question not my judgment, Malachi. I am the giver of his word.
That is John Franklin as Isaac and Courtney Gaines as Malachi, a movie face you will not forget from 1984's Children of the Corn. It was written by George Goldsmith, based on the book by Stephen King, of course. The director was Fritz Kirsch. Now, that massacre was part of our special Halloween episode a couple weeks back. We included a Sacred Cow review of a better-known and loved horror flick from 84, A Nightmare on Elm Street. We also had a Valley of Violence director, Ty West, join us for that show and talk about our top five childhood movie scares. So you know I have to ask you, Michael. We're talking about here now movies you saw as a kid, the scenes, the moments, the images that just scared the crap out of you way too early.
Wasn't comfortable with Mysterious Island, which I saw on television probably when I was five. And
that's young.
The crab, the giant crab going after the guy. Not comfortable with that. I always cite this because I never tire of beating up on this beloved movie. But seeing It's a Mad, 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 Mad World with my brother when I was nine,
okay,
in the theatrical re-release. That was the most frightening movie experience of my life because it was the first time I really felt truly trapped by a movie and not enjoying it and wondering the whole time, why are all these people I love, like Jonathan Winters?
Okay.
And I was a big comedy nerd back then. And I just thinking, why are they all not funny? Why do I want to kill myself? Why is this movie still going? Why? Oh my God! There's another hour. You know, that was a nightmare.
So that was more aesthetic horror you were experiencing.
Yeah,
there
but
than
truly
like personal.
But I mean, you know, it gave me the cold creeps in a way that I associate with horror films. But Mysterious Island, if I had to pick a giant crab.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like how you phrase that too. Wasn't comfortable with it. You've already repressed that and put nice phrasing around it. I wasn't comfortable with it. We heard from listeners regarding our Children of the Corn performance making a few of the connections for us, including Ken Link in Flagstaff, Arizona. The film cited in the most recent Massacre Theater was apparently 1984's Children of the Quinoa, or Corn. I knew it as soon as you mentioned Isaac. We switched a little bit with the wording there to throw people off. The tie-in is that, like Sacred Cow, A Nightmare on Elm Street, it is a horror movie filmed in 1984. A second tie-in is that in another selection for childhood scares, I'm anxious to learn which of you is now afraid of cornfields.
Joseph Holler says, the answer is clearly Children of the Corn, another of the terribly delightful Stephen King film canon of the 1980s. Right up there, if not better than, such other terrible yet completely watchable King movies such as Maximum Overdrive,
oh, yeah,
and Pet Sematary. Do not confuse these with the actual good Stephen King movies like The Shining, Stand By Me, and Misery.
Maximum Overdrive, that's the one with like the killer electronic devices, right? Like,
yeah, I
like
never saw
toasters
it.
And things.
I saw Children of the Corn. Saw
and,
that.
And?
Oh, I haven't eaten it since. You know. Either. I haven't eaten children or corn since.
I meanwhile, go out of my. I'll drive 10 miles out of my way to avoid a cornfield. So
I saw the sequel. I saw Children of the Corn 2. I remember reviewing that.
There is Children of the Corn 2.
I reviewed that for the Weekly in Minneapolis. Yeah.
Sean Cabry also wrote in. He's currently in Stuart, Florida. Usually, I don't try to identify the movies you massacre, preferring instead to lose myself in the axe-hewn nuances of the performance. Because I am a horror genre fan, my pride demanded that I make an exception this time around. Adam's Isaac immediately took me back to being 12 years old, alone for the evening in a secluded cabin, watching a VHS copy of Children of the Corn on a 14-inch screen. Not the best horror flick, not even the best King adaptation, but that night, it had the desired effect on me. Every light in the house was on until my parents came home. So I have a question here. Do you think Sean grew up in an isolated cabin? Or was he on vacation for this scenario? And the way he describes it, I can't quite tell.
Did he seek out the seclusion? I think he's actually dreaming that part. I don't.
That could be.
That sounds too much like a horror film to me.
Hadn't considered that. Ryan Finley wrote in as well. The scene from this week's episode was Children of the Corn. Here are the tie-ins I could find. Children of the Corn was released the same year as this week's review, Nightmare on Elm Street, 84. It turns the show's top five theme on its head a bit, as it's a horror movie where the children themselves are the scare. It also stars Linda Hamilton, who is 1 degree separated from another conversation from this episode, Hamilton the Musical. With that out of the way, how about some more hard-to-pronounce Wisconsin cities? And here, Ryan lists a couple of said cities. Michael, I associate you with Wisconsin. Grew up there?
Yeah. Is that right? Born in Kenosha, grew up in Racine.
There you go. So I'm going to hand this over to you without looking at the phonetic spelling.
I got to look at that. No,
here.
I've already looked.
Go ahead. Read them anyway.
Ashwaubenon? Nobody should live in a town like that.
Oh, boy.
Kaukauna. That's easy enough. Wyawega. That's my favorite, Wyawega. Well, my favorite is Oconomowoc, the Milwaukee suburb of Oconomowoc.
Which is what started all of this trouble on the show. And after those pronunciations, I think it's fair to say I'm free from all of the Wisconsin hate mail, and it's going to be coming directly to you, and I'm happy about that.
I'm a native. I'll take it.
Ryan finishes his note here. Those crazy Wisconsinites, thanks for a great show. Okay. I did not get access to the film spotting hat, so I cannot tell what degree of brimming it is in terms of submissions for Children of the Corn. But go ahead, Michael, and read the name of our winner.
I'm going to read the name right now. Matt McCafferty in Piles Grove, New Jersey.
Congratulations, Matt. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your prize.
How did I come to this?
Not again.
I played Richard III.
Five curtain calls.
Five curtain calls. I was an actor once. Damn it, now look at me. Look at me! I can't go out there and I won't say that stupid line one more time.
Well, this is going to get contentious, Michael. We should probably acknowledge from the start.
This will not be like any scene from Loving.
No, it will not.
No.
This one scene is louder than the entirety of Loving. I hope we can be cordial after. There's still a lot of show to do, so let's separate fiction from reality. Are you ready, to go? All right, I guess you are starting it off. And action.
Hello, gentlemen. Nice of you to come on such short notice. General Decker, it seems I owe you an apology.
Hey, we all make mistakes, Mr. President.
Not anymore. We're going to take charge of this thing.
Excellent, sir. I have prepared the order.
What's this?
Oh, that's your executive order authorizing full use of our nuclear deterrent, sir.
Are you out of your mind? I'm not going to start a war.
We're already at war, sir. We have to nuke them. We have to nuke them now.
General Decker, if you do not shut up, I'm going to relieve you of your command.
We have to strike now, sir. Annihilate. Kill. Kill. Kill.
Shut up. Shut up. Shut up.
And
scene.
Let's bring it down. Are we good?
Okay.
No hard feelings?
Yeah.
Okay. If you know what film we massacred, email the movie's title along with your name.
It's okay. I'm a professional actor.
And location to feedback at filmspotting.net. The deadline, well, we got a little while for this one. It's going to be Monday, December 5. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced in a couple of weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
What the hell is your delay, Captain?
We're waiting, sir.
Waiting for what?
Private Doss.
Who the hell is Private Doss?
I always dreamed about being a doctor, but didn't get much school. I can't stay here while all them go fight for me.
What, you figure this war is just going to fit in with your ideas?
Well,
while everybody else is taking life, I'm gonna be saving it.
That's gonna be my way to serve.
Some of the trailer there for Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge. It's the true story of Desmond Doss, played by Andrew Garfield, a World War II medic in the United States Army, who was the first conscientious objector, due to his Christian beliefs concerning violence, to win the Medal of Honor. Michael, this was a film you had said you'd like to fit in on this show. And after seeing it, I can only ask, why?
Why? Because I want to torture you. I want to torture you.
Really, it is more my exhaustion from enduring, you know, this heavily violent and gruesome film that I say that than any sort of facetiousness. But I am curious, what struck you about the picture?
Well, okay, it's a faith-based film made by a guy who, you know, and there's more than one faith in the world, God knows it, you know. But, I mean, you know, this is obviously an area of expertise for you. And if not necessarily this religion, which is, you know, Doss was the Seventh-day Adventist.
Right.
It's when I saw it at the Venice Film Festival, I kind of came out into my as a minority opinion of kind of grudging respect for some of the craft of the thing, but kind of like thinking it was, you know, a typical hypocritical mixture of piety and brutality that Mel Gibson absolutely lives for as a filmmaker. Mm. But I was kind of puzzled that it got such respect from a lot of my critical peers over there. And, you know, I saw it again a second time because I always need to see things a second time after a film
sure.
festival airing. But I guess I wanted to hear from you if you thought any of the spiritual aspects of this man's story are treated well, or treated in a way that we don't usually see in movies.
Yeah, I think for me it was another entry more in Mel Gibson's spirituality than Desmond Doss's. Not that I know the Doss story all that well at all. This was really the first time I had come across it, and it's a fascinating one. I mean, what a subject to choose for a World War II picture. But I saw it more in line with this cinema of gore and spirituality that Gibson – I mean, you could say it goes back to his early days as an actor, where so many of his characters achieved victory
or martyrdom,
pain.
Yeah, or martyrdom.
Or
yeah.
martyrdom.
Yeah.
But I think the distinction for Gibson – and this brings us to Hacksaw Ridge – is also – focusing on the actual rending of flesh, and that there is something
he loves it.
But there's something there that he's trying to get at, in that it isn't just the martyring, it isn't just the suffering. It is the desecration of the body that yes. he seems to equate with glory, with salvation. And there's something, you know, to be honest, I'm still wrestling with that, and I'm going to be writing a piece for the day job at Think Christian that explores more theology of the body stuff and try to wrap my head around that. So I'll try to link to that if I get that done before this show goes up. But just as a movie itself, I found this focus to be relentless and to be exhausting, not to be very revealing in terms of Doss's own personal beliefs.
Right,
it almost
right.
seemed to use his story, which is one of pacifism and conviction, as an entry point onto the battlefield
right,
where
right.
we could get back to what Gibson wants to focus
right,
on,
exactly.
which is the gore.
And, exactly.
And here's where that sunk home to me. The movie does, to be fair, give you plenty of images of Doss and his healing hands on the battlefield. We'll see that. He's delivering morphine. He's applying a tourniquet.
Right.
Those sorts of things. It's far outweighed by cataloging how grenades blow a body apart, how limbs are removed, how arteries spurt.
Okay.
That gets the majority of
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well,
go ahead.
So what I'm getting at is there is a moment where Doss wins, not by saving these 70-some men that we watch him save. The movie goes back to the battlefield after that. His glory moment comes when he himself is injured. So in other words, it's not until he suffers physically does he get his ticket to heaven punched. That's when we get that shot of him on the stretcher, the camera's
ascending to the
and
heavens.
What a camera move. It swings from above Doss to underneath him as he's being lowered from this ridge, and it almost changes physics so that we know he's going down. But when we look at him that way, it seems like he's rising up.
Right, right.
And again,
right.
it's all about that actual violence against your body is more important than any sort of greater conviction that might be a part of.
So how come you don't fight? You think you're better than us?
No.
But what if he was attacked?
Whoa!
Say it like that. Bible says to turn the other cheek, don't it? See, I don't think this is a question of religion, fellas. I think this is cowardice. Plain and simple.
Is that right, Doss?
Well, go on. Take a poke! Tell you what, I'm gonna give you a free shot. Huh? Right there. Hit me, Doss. Go on.
Let him have it.
Go ahead.
No?
I think Gibson's by... And I don't want to get into... There's no. We don't need to get into everything that he's dealt with and perpetrated off screen, you know, and that's we've
there's plenty on screen,
screen, but I think he the way that he has, as one of the producers and the director of this thing, helped shape the screenplay, which he did not write. It's all about, you know, really amping up the bullying and the physical torment the guy Doss endures in basic training. Because he's sticking to his CO, conscientious and objective beliefs, and will not carry a rifle. And then, as you say, once you get to the battlefield, which, you know, the movie begins, you know, this is all very craftily kind of setting you up to sit through the pacifism so you can get the gore in the second hour. You get the prologue, slow motion, you know, Japanese soldiers on fire. Everybody's on fire in the prologue in slow motion. And, it's kind of goes back to this, what little I know about Seventh-day Adventists, to their kind of hellfire imagery, which is not, specific only to that religion. But, you know, Gibson loves that stuff. It's cinematic, and it's in that horrible, hypocritical way. It's cool, quote, cool imagery of horrible things, right? And then you deal with Doss and his, this very difficult, harsh growing up, physically abused by his father. And then you get to Okinawa, 1945, and that's basically the whole second hour of the film. And Gibson... I guess you can give him this much credit. He can always simplify and map out and stage an action scene so that you know it's lucid. Now, what are you being shown? That's another question. My issues with Hacksaw Ridge are very much in line with yours, I think. It's just that he can't get enough of the kind of – it's all really kind of video gamer-type violence but treated much more realistically, where it's just simply shredded limbs, people grabbing torsos of recently killed soldiers and using them as human shields so they can mow down a bunch of Japanese – it's all that kind of violence. And it all builds – a lot of it builds to applause points where the Americans kill the Japanese, that I found kind of galling, frankly. This is not a film that knows anything about the moral horror of combat or war. It's just simply trying to get you roused up, you know?
Yeah, I felt that too. But I got to say, to be fair, and also, to take into consideration the actual suffering, both American and Japanese, that took place in conflicts like that, this is not to dismiss that, to dismiss this film. I'm afraid, because this is getting positive reviews, and I think you do as well, it's probably going to be a big hit, that those lines are going to be blurred. And it was interesting for me because I went to see this. This is the second film I've talked about on the show recently that I went to see with my grandfather, who's 92, World War II vet. He was in the Navy.
Pretty rough for anybody of that sensibility.
Well, it was interesting. Now, he was, again, Navy, so in the Pacific Theater, but not on these islands.
Yeah.
So this wasn't his direct experience, but I saw it with him, and, he thought it was a fantastic film. And it was interesting to me, particularly, I asked him about the gore and, what he made of that. And he just said, those were the stories I heard, for him. So I bring all that up to say is I don't think I'm saying Hacksaw Ridge is necessarily depicting things that might not have happened. But it's more the focus on those things.
And the tone.
Value given to those things. Now, you are right. Like Gibson is a very more than competent action and battle scene director. There is a clarity here to these scenes, to the advance. You know where the Americans are trying to get and how the Japanese are entrenched. And those scenes are really well handled. So you have to give him credit for that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say well handled. I would say lucid, which is different.
I guess that's what I mean.
Yeah, visually lucid.
In terms of action, like my first requirement is that, just let me know what's going on. Because so many of our acclaimed action directors can't do that.
Righto.
So I certainly acknowledge that Gibson has that ability. I don't think he has quite as firm of a handle on the opening segment that shows Doss's, young adulthood in Virginia. I think Andrew Garfield is way off tone in those scenes. He's almost doing Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
And they try to force in some humor.
I think it's slightly inadvertently patronizing to these rural,
yes.
These good, simple rural folk. And I think there may just be simply a matter of it's kind of cultural dislocation. Every actor except for Vince Vaughn is the drill sergeant.
He's pretty culturally dislocated as well, though, yeah, right. I would say.
But they're either from the British Isles or they're from Australia. And so it's all about learning. And the film was shot in Australia. And it all feels a little like fake Americana to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
old-timey.
It's old-timey. And
more than authentic.
Yeah. And you're only really getting kind of one impulse, one emotion at a time. It's not a film that ever hits two notes at once. And that's – I just think my main resistance to the Okinawa sequences, really that once Gibson gets going with really, really throwing all the worst of the horror imagery, you know, the body shredding, you know, the truly awful violence of it all, some of which is completely historically valid, all that, Doss falls out of his own movie. You don't ever see these things through his eyes. And that just dramatically is a failing, I think, because he kind of dips in and out of his own story there for a while. And yeah, he does do this amazing and truly historically grounded, amazing cleanup job where he saved 75 some lives that were basically left for dead on the battlefield. And he essentially single-handedly saved all these lives. Amazing. And that is why this is a story worth telling. It's also why it's kind of a shame that it wasn't handled by a director who, as I say, isn't more of a grown-up, who isn't just trying to, you know, it's almost like a dare. It's like somebody told Mel Gibson, hey, I dare you to make a movie that's like five times gorier than the D-Day scene in Saving Private Ryan. Oh, can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take that challenge. And, yeah. here we have it.
He really does try to make that look like a pillow fight or something. So that's two who are pretty down on Hacksaw Ridge, but I think we're going to be kind of on our own on this. So if listeners have seen it and found other things to appreciate about it, let us know. You can send those thoughts to feedback@filmspotting.net. So no top five this week. There are just too many movies to get to as we near the end of the year.
How about top five list? Top five reasons we can't get to the top five. Number one, too many movies, end of the year.
Yeah. Two, number two.
Number two, no interest.
Okay. Well, okay.
Number three, four, and five to be determined.
I don't think we need any more reasons after number two. Michael and I, instead, we're going to have a review of one of those movies. We wanted to see Denis Villeneuve's Arrival in just a moment. Stay with us.
I feel unhappy. I feel so sad. That I ever had. She was my woman. I love her so. But it's too late now. I let her go.
Define your story beyond your life. Like the day they arrived.
Signs of what might be called first contact. The objects measure at least.
I'm Colonel G.T. Weber from Army Intelligence.
Pack your bags.
You're at the top of everyone's list when it comes to translations.
Priority one. What do they want? Where are they from? You'll be reporting to me, but you'll be working with him when you're in the show.
That's what they call in the UFO.
Who's being carted off in the medevac?
Not everyone is wired for what you're about to do.
So what do they look like?
You'll see soon enough.
Every 18 hours, a door opens up. That's where we go in.
a little bit of the trailer for the film Arrival by French-Canadian filmmaker Denis Villeneuve. And Josh, I have a question for you. Arrival has arrived. What are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about this problem? This is the fourth English language feature from Villeneuve. First came Prisoners in 2013. That was the one with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal about child abduction and vigilante revenge justice. Then came Enemy, a much further out there fantasy about a history professor whose doppelganger is an actor, also played by Gyllenhaal. And then came Sicario, Emily Blunt as an FBI agent recruited to aid an undercover cartel-busting operation on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. And now, Arrival. This is with Amy Adams as a linguistics professor who's enlisted by the U.S. military when 12 mysterious hovering egg-shaped spacecraft enter Earth's orbit and just park themselves all over the planet, about 100 feet or so above the Earth's surface. Jeremy Renner plays a theoretical physicist who teams up with Adams to figure out what it's going to take to communicate with these guys. The problem is, once the highly advanced and sophisticated language the aliens use is decoded by the Adams character, the question of interpreting or misinterpreting the language and figuring out the meaning comes into play. And all the days and nights she's getting to know this strange new life form. Louise, the Adams character, has memories, flashbacks of when her daughter was alive. And that's a little link, I think, really to Gravity and Sandra Bullock's backstory, which I should point out, I'm not spoiling anything here by saying this. This is stuff you learn in the first 3 minutes of Arrival. So that's not a spoiler, I would say.
Or do you?
Or do you? Okay. So here's my question for you, Josh. Arrival, does it make a strong case for itself as a search for signs of intelligent life in this movie genre? Or is it really more pretension than satisfaction? Where'd you come down?
Well, first of all, I'm going to go the Brody route and say it's nothing compared to 1996's The Arrival starring Charlie Sheen. I mean, that's really what we should be paying attention to.
Talk about aliens.
Yes.
Talk about alien behavior, man.
So you said Arrival's arrived and it's a problem. It is a problem because there are, and I just saw this last night, so still processing a little bit. There are some things I really, really liked about this movie and then some things that are frustrating to me, and some things that are just plain baffling. And I'm wondering how much of that do I put on myself at this point. I'm going to be completely honest with you.
You're easily baffled.
I am easily baffled, so take that into account. But at the end of this movie, it wasn't till the credits were running where I started to think, okay, is that what just happened? And then I heard someone sitting not too far away talking with the person next to him. It's like, okay, I think that's it. And I saw Genevieve Kosky and Tasha Robinson from the Next Picture Show. They were at the same screening about five rows down. I just went to them and said, I need some help here.
Right.
here's what I'm thinking. Am I crazy? And we worked it out. They seemed to be a little bit ahead of the game than I was. I'm just wondering, am I that dumb?
No.
Or is this movie – is it not that this movie is incomprehensible, but is it trying to trick you unfairly? And I guess what that means is there is a reveal towards the last third. Obviously, we're not going to get into more than that in the last maybe 10 minutes. And I'm just trying to wrestle with, is that something that I should have been able as a viewer to appreciate more easily because of the filmmaking?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And this is a damn hard movie to talk about without dealing with spoilers.
It really is.
Because it is, you know, it is kind of woven into the plot fully. This idea of the meaning of a lot of what we're seeing, it becomes, is explained to us in a way we don't initially perceive it. And what the Amy Adams character is going through and kind of what she's haunted by with this, the death of her daughter we see in sort of flashbacks.
Which, you're right, is in the first minute of the movie.
Yeah.
So that's not spoiling anything.
Right. It's different from the way Sandra Bullock's character in Gravity is kind of, you know, where we're hit with the backstory of, you know, the tragedy she's escaping back on Earth, essentially. This is different. I do think that this is a peculiar film, which I think is worth seeing, and I admire it, I think, more than you. The director is one sleek craftsman, man. This guy can really work well with a cinematographer, and there's such a stealthy, careful sense of kind of like slow building suspense in the camera movement, and
the shadow. You know, he's really into very, very kind of like heavy, artful shadows and keeping his actors half hidden half the time, but not in a way that totally dismisses the performances. I think Amy Adams, as good as she is the reason the movie does sort of have a human pulse. But I don't know. A lot of what works about it is this slow, stealthy, careful, methodical pacing, and a lot of what doesn't work about it is when that sort of slips over to kind of a slackening of tension, and then that coupled with this sort of increasingly knotty plotting where you're like, okay, no, wait, what is that? What's the implication here? Or you mean all the time, da-da-da-da-da-da?
Yeah.
I've been misreading this, and I think it's going to frustrate audiences, and this is not a industry watchdog show. We're not working for Variety or Hollywood Reporter, but I think you can't help but notice when you get that kind of murmuring in the audience or outside by the concessions or in the restroom where it's like, wow, I don't know. You know, you just feel right. Like it's not quite working on its own terms if it's leading to not just narrative ambiguity, but narrative confusion.
Sure. Yeah, and that goes both ways. I think it will frustrate audiences. I think you also have audiences who clue in on it earlier than I did and will find it to be mind-blowing and be one of those where if you're in on this right when the movie wants you to be, then it's a very rewarding experience. So I agree with you. People should check it out and see it. Beyond that, there are a number of things that I can recommend. Just the conception of these alien ships alone and
how
the film envisions them. And they are these strange shapes levitating maybe 20 feet off the ground. The scenes of Adams and the other scientists entering inside and how gravity shifts and they can walk up the wall. Those are handled.
Great.
This is where Villeneuve's, you know, skills as a suspense filmmaker really come into effect, where he draws those out just enough without teasing us unnecessarily to making us feel that we're there with those characters.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie's very smart, I think, in getting its worth out of the alien creature reveal,
yep,
but not putting too much emphasis on that, because we do see them probably within 20 minutes. And after that, they almost become characters
in
a way.
Yeah.
And I think they're very fascinatingly designed, and they also reveal this method of communication. I don't want to give anything away in terms of the creature reveal either, but this method of communication they have is very visual.
Yeah.
And the movie uses that. I was all on board with this and found it fascinating as an exploration just of communication.
Yeah, same. I agree.
And how this linguist is going to figure out, they compare it to history, you know, to two civilizations meeting in history and how those have gone awry and how you need to do that. That was really good stuff.
I think for an hour, two-thirds of this film, it really does feel like good, really good grown-up science fiction where you're kind of dealing more with ideas than just, you know, cheap thrills. And, you know, he's proving every scene that you can develop suspense and keep an audience with you in kind of a state of wonderment, you know, or even a slight puzzlement, but wonderment too for a long time. Then, you know, his bugaboo, I think, is that just like Sicario, just like Prisoners, this film, Arrival, does just narratively kind of go slack and get much more kind of hackneyed and a little confused toward the end. And I don't know anybody who thought the best stuff in Sicario was the last 40 minutes. It's really all what leads up to it. And I think he's such a strong imagist and such a strong visual filmmaker. Maybe he doesn't pay attention enough in development to whether or not, you know, the story's working. It just makes me realize how hard screenwriting is.
Sure.
And especially if you have any ambition and you want to deal with some real ideas and put some identifiable human behavior inside a genre like science fiction or alien invasion or whatever it is. And, you know, I hope people take a chance on it. It's discombobulating. It'll frustrate a lot of people, as you say. It'll frustrate you even if you like it most of the way. But I think he's a good enough filmmaker that I went with it almost all the way through. And that's, you know, for me, that's good enough.
Looking at his other films, you know, I think there's maybe the most direct through line to Enemy, which is the one of his that I actually appreciate the least.
It
wants to reorient you in this sort of mind-blowing way. And that's very ambitious and bold for a filmmaker to try to do, very difficult to pull off. And I guess that aspect of both films I didn't find to be quite as successful. A couple other things that I think do hold Arrival back is there's this subplot involving a rogue soldier, let's just say,
and
an act that they take that – sort of comes out of nowhere and isn't even really necessary. And then there is a cheat. And this goes back to my idea of, you know, is the movie playing fairly and trying to trick us? There is a cheat where the aliens make a giant leap forward in communication ability right when the plot needs them to.
Yeah, yeah.
and even, you know, subtitles come into play.
I know.
Kind of like, okay, you've been so good about creating this realistic methodology.
Right.
And now when things are amping up, we're going to go to this. So
it's like the aliens discovered the remote and they realized, oh, we can have subtitles
yes,
on.
Yes. Yeah. we should have been doing this all along. I do think Adams is good in it and provides, a solid rooting at first, especially because the movie does open with those scenes of her daughter. I was a little about using that as a plot device, yeah. You know, but especially when it involves children. I know for some people, his film Prisoners is just intolerable for this in terms of child endangerment being a plot device. I think there are other good things going on in Prisoners, but
in the first hour.
But I do think Adams, finds the real humanity in that sort of experience and picks out certain moments and knows how to play them. So it does come across as a genuine trauma this character knows rather than just something to move the plot forward.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. I think she's also actress enough now. I don't know if 5 years or 10 movies ago she would have had the instincts to really have such kind of a clean, spare technique and just really very simple work, but very true and moving, I thought.
In 1770, Captain James Cook's ship ran aground off the coast of Australia and he led a party into the country and they met the Aboriginal people. One of the sailors pointed at the animals that hop around and put their babies in their pouch and he asked what they were and the Aborigines said, kangaroo. It wasn't until later that they learned that kangaroo means I don't understand.
I can sell that for now.
Yeah.
And remember what happened to the Aborigines? A more advanced race nearly wiped them out.
It's a good story.
Thanks. It's not true. But it proves my point.
Yeah, she's good. And I think I wouldn't say he's primarily an actor's director, but he tends to get everybody in this same world in a kind of brooding and sort of authentic way, I think. But whether or not people swing with these increasingly challenging plot strategies toward the end, I don't know. I did not read the source material. I did not read the Ted Chiang short story called Story of Your Life. And I don't know if that would have answered some questions I had or sort of wrapped things up more gratifyingly. I'm not sure, but I do love how divisive the screening seemed last night, though,
yeah,
to Arrival, where you actually kind of did – you could hear some audible eye rolls, you know, like the woman next to me was like, oh, my God, you know, a couple of things toward the end. And then, but I think in the first hour especially, there was a real sense of quiet, like they were in it. They were in it.
Oh, you know, sure.
And the way the reveal – as you say, the reveals are paced about kind of what these – aliens actually look like and what does it look like inside the spaceship. A lot of this definitely has inspirations from Close Encounters of the Third Kind and a little bit of Kubrick and actually a lot of in those flashbacks with mother-daughter, a lot of Terrence Malick
because yes.
Suddenly you go to Handheld and Wheat.
And they're amidst nature, yes.
Yeah,
they're on the shoreline often, yeah.
So, you know, he's not above sampling a lot of our most familiar sort of visual stylist, but I think he's also craftsman enough that he's made, again, like Jeff Nichols, a filmmaker he has nothing visually in common with, he's never made an interesting film yet.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Now, we should probably get into spoiler talk. That's about all I think we can say without giving too much away. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe if Adam gets a chance to catch up with this, we can get into some of the nitty-gritty about the spoiler elements here. But certainly let us know in general what you make of Arrival if you do see it when it opens in wide release this weekend. Send those thoughts to feedback@filmspotting.net. We do, of course, love it when we get voicemails as well. So if there's anything about the show in general or Arrival itself that you want us to know, go ahead and call us at 312-264-0744. You can find that number under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, of course, on Twitter, Adams at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. Michael, I know you don't have nearly enough trolls. So where can people find you on the internet?
The people who are going to just write me and say, you're a tool, can do that on Twitter. You know, Phillips Tribune okay. is the handle.
Or I thought maybe you had a special email set up just for
not
those.
Yet. Okay. Maybe next year. But in general, they can. If I had to tell you where to find the stuff I'm writing, it's usually at chicagotribune.com/movies.
Thanks for filling in. It's always good to get
fun.
You in the studio and
right.
Knock out a couple of film reviews.
We knocked off three reviews.
I know. How about that?
Let's go.
If you want to go over to filmspotting.net, you will find not just this show, but also 11 years of reviews, interviews, top fives. Those are all in the show archives. That's also the place to vote in our film spotting poll. We're asking you, why are you going to see Moana this Thanksgiving? Couple of options for you there. And if you haven't already, we do ask that you check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts, The Next Picture Show and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or on your podcast app. And in a few weeks, you'll be able to find us both in live recordings here in Chicago, November 18 for us and Film Spotting SVU, November 19 for The Next Picture Show. In limited release this weekend is Creepy. That comes from J-horror director Kiyoshi Kurosawa of Pulse and Tokyo Sonata. In wide release, it is the holiday movie season, Michael. That means almost Christmas will be upon us. Dysfunctional family gets together for Christmas. Danny Glover and Omar Epps are starring in that one. Another wide release, Shut-In. A reclusive child psychologist played by Naomi Watts is caught in a deadly winter storm. And we have Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. This is Ang Lee's latest. He's shooting in 120 frames per second for this one. And Arrival, which Michael and I just reviewed, is going to be out in wide release. Next week, we're going to have our 2016 Golden Brick preview. And then next Friday, as I mentioned, that's our live show with Matt Nelson from Film Spotting SVU. That's going to be part of the Chicago Podcast Festival. So the plan is to post that show the following week. That's going to be the 25th. We're going to be sharing our top five movies that console and restore hope there, kind of assuming we could all use a little hope, a little consoling after the bruising election cycle. Now, as of this taping, we do have a few tickets left for that live show on November 18. For more information about getting those, we would love to see you there. Visit filmspotting.net or chicagopodcastfestival.com.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org.
Thank you again, Michael. Quick note, our music this week is by Charles Bradley. It's from the album Changes. There's more information at thecharlesbradley.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Michael Phillips, filling in for the great Adam Kempinar, opposite the equally great, but not, we're opposite. That. Try it again.
Too much.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.